This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, a weekly podcast hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Full of Beans is here to share the unheard voices of those who are living with, supporting, researching, or working in the field of eating disorders. Each conversation aims to bring a different perspective and understanding so that together we can learn, advocate, and connect to realise we are not alone in our struggles and that recovery is possible. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode. And just a gentle reminder that these episodes are not a replacement for therapeutic support, so if you are struggling, please do reach out and know that there will always be someone there to listen. And finally, thank you to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital, for your continued support. In this week's episode, I'm joined by George Mycock. George is a PhD candidate at the University of Worcester, studying men's help seeking and access to care for eating, exercise and body image concerns. George is also involved in several projects, including the Mental Health and Movement Alliance at the Charity Mind, the Steering Group for the National Audit of Eating Disorders and the Royal College of Psychiatrists, co-leading a project with the Consider Male Eating Disorders team from Nottingham University and King's College London. George joins us today to discuss his PhD research focusing on how male eating disorder services can make them more accessible for men and his hope for future awareness. I absolutely loved this episode. As you guys probably know, George is one of my bestest friends, and so to be able to sit down and chat to him all about his research was incredible. I really hope that you enjoy this episode and our giggles along the way. Are you happy?
All good.
Amazing. I don't know how to start it because I always start it so cheesily, but like, it's you.
I did think that because I was listening to a couple of your episodes before we started and I was like, the vibe feels is going to be so different.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Oh, this feels gross.
You should keep this in.
This is just it. Let's just go. Let's just be it. How are you?
I am, as spoken beforehand, I'm kind of mixed at the moment. I on paper, very good. PhD is coming to an end. I've basically written my thesis. It's just editing it, which does take a long time. And, you know, but I've written all like 80,000 words or so that I'm close to. Got a new job recently, which is exciting. Like my first postdoc thing, even though I'm technically not postdoc, but sometimes you get them just before anyway. Really good. But as we were speaking about beforehand, I have this weird relationship with positive praise where it makes the imposter syndrome grow to this like monster. And also makes me fearful that people are expecting me to constantly be doing achieving things, and that feels like extra pressure suddenly, which is strange. But yeah, how are you doing?
I'm good. But I think I can relate to that. I don't know whether this is how you feel, but I get an element of
somebody's going to call my bluff. Like somebody's going to realize that I'm actually not this good and I'm going to get called out. My mum always says to me, right, okay, imposter syndrome, hello. In a court of law, what evidence do you have? And I'm like, none.
Yeah, it feels so counterintuitive for me, but I like my imposter syndrome has gotten so much worse since I've done the PhD as well, because I feel like in a court of law I do have evidence because I'm aware of all the stuff that I don't know now because I'm constantly trying to read it and not having the time to, so I have all this stuff I don't know. But yeah, it's yeah, I genuinely hand on heart believe that the like groups that I'm in that people ask me to be involved in and like the projects I'm involved in, I fully think that I've tricked them. Like I understand that it sounds ridiculous and it takes me saying it out loud to realize it, but like my actual like soul is certain I've fooled them. Like and apparently that's imposter syndrome and everyone says that they all feel it, but I'm like if this is actually what we all feel like, that's crazy.
But I mean, surely there's got to be varying degrees of it. Like anxiety, for example, some people feel a little bit anxious. Some people like can't get out of bed in the morning because they're so anxious. I mean, I know this isn't helpful to say, but like whenever I talk about you to anybody, it's always like George is the go-to person for muscle dysmorphia. But since you doing this PhD, I think it's male eating disorders now. Like it's not just muscle dysmorphia. It's the whole array. And I know when we were at the conference the other day, you were saying, you know, don't just talk to me. I'm just one man. And there's loads of other men with eating disorders. But in terms of like within the research space, you literally are the leading voice for it.
I don't know. I agree that there are people who think that. And some of those people are like big names. I really try to acknowledge the good things about me, and I believe that you believe that. I believe that other people believe it. I think in the UK I'm one of the most vocal, and maybe that means that people like me. The thing is, I know my shit. I know I do, because I talk about it in front of people who really know their shit, and they don't call me out. So I must be right. I found it really hard to think about. It was funny. I'm in a steering group for the National Audit of Eating Disorders at the Royal College of Psychiatrists. And in the first meeting, this is one of those things that you think about in the shower, you know, when you're like, and you have like the cringe moment. They said, like, does anyone have anyone else? They like any areas that we think we should get an expert involved who we don't currently have. And I like raised my hand and said, like, oh, we need someone who's got like expertise in men's eating disorders, you know, men's eating disorders. And they were like, that's you. The response was like, we thought that was you. And I was like, yeah, I guess so. In my head, I was like, it needs to be like a clinician or something. But they were all like, well, we've all got clinical experience, like working with men sometimes. Whereas like, you're the guy for the research. And I was like, God, I am the guy for the research. Jesus. And yeah, that was an interesting moment. But yeah, I'm just saying it's to that level. Like I'm sat in the meeting and I'm still like, why am I here? Yeah.
But you know what? I think that if somebody's listening, and because ultimately, like you said, like I think we all have imposter syndrome, but so often I think we can feel it in ourselves, but we don't see it in other people. And I think that often the people with the most intense imposter syndrome do appear very confident. You know, listening to you on Friday, if I didn't know you, I would not think that you, you know, did have imposter syndrome, because you speak so well, so confidently, so eloquently, you explain things in such a good way. So actually for people listening, maybe if they're, you know, thinking, I've got really bad imposter syndrome, but I'm the only one, then I don't think that's often something that's spoken about within the research world. So it's quite a refreshing thing to hear.
Yeah. And I think they all, like all researchers, feel it to some degree, partially just because the nature of academia is people are constantly calling you out on your like assumptions and stuff. So we all are, you know, I think one of the reasons imposter syndrome exists, and I will shut up about this in a second, but one of the reasons it exists is because we see the highlight reel of everyone else, whereas we experience every failure that we make throughout the day. And in academia, that happens. And also all of your colleagues point out your mistakes too constantly.
Yeah.
So it's just this like, yeah, this echo chamber of just constantly being told like where you're going wrong, and in a loving and, you know, supportive way, and sometimes, but you know, there is I think it's the kind of haven for imposter syndrome.
Yeah, well, you're literally, everything you do is completely picked apart and told do it again. And I think you have to you definitely have to develop some skills for being able to take that feedback on board. But let's talk PhD. Let's talk what this conversation is all about. So I guess, do you want to give us a, you've written 80,000 words on it, but maybe if we've got a shorter synopsis.
Oh, I actually have it printed out here. I was going to read it all out. Yeah. No, synopsis. I don't actually have like a proper title yet. I feel like that's the last thing I'm going to do because I don't know how to summarize it properly. But the basic thing is what we looked at was, we know that there are a substantial amount of men with eating disorders and with, I use the term EBIP in my research, which is eating, exercise, and body image psychopathology, which is basically a term to encompass eating disorders, body dysmorphic disorder, muscle dysmorphia, and people's experiences that are kind of not recognized by diagnostic criteria. But for the sake of this podcast, I'll just say eating disorders, but just know that I'm being a bit more kind of wibbly wobbly with it. And I can talk about that more if we want to. But the idea was to look at the fact that we know that a lot of men experience these things, but we know that not many of them get through to clinical settings or get through to actually accessing care. And we wanted to look at what are the reasons they are, that might be, and then kind of drive into one of those areas. And the areas we drove into were the kind of system level, the service level barriers and issues. And then finally worked on coming up with a facilitator, which is this guidance document that I'll talk about later today. But yeah, really looking at like understanding what's stopping them from accessing care and then how can we help them.
Just one thing that I don't think I've asked you actually that I'm interested in, just with relation to the term EBIP, was the thought behind that, because sometimes the term eating disorder isn't something that maybe men can relate to, or was there another thought process behind that?
The main thought process, I mean, there's several. There's almost an entire chapter in my thesis describing why that term exists, so it would take too long to go into the ins and outs. To some degree, yes, it's the fact that men don't align with it. But even stepping back a bit, it's kind of the reasons men often don't align with it is because if we kind of look at historically at body image research and also like eating disorder research, although some of the very, very earlier cases spoke about men's experiences, from then up until kind of the 80s, 90s, men were very rarely included in any of the research. So most of our like underpinning theoretical assumptions, the way that we conceptualize and understand these are based on women's experiences, based on researchers speaking to women and hearing what they think. And then the issue is as well that even the theories, like the theories since then, we've updated them often and like made them kind of work for men or to see how they can fit around men. But we use what the researchers often use, and understandably, because it would take a long time otherwise, but they've used what's called a deductive approach, where they've taken the theory that they made around women and gone, how can we fit men into this? Like, how can we change it to fit men into it? And that's not quite the same as what they did with women or what they did with the original theories, where they use an inductive approach, where they go, let's just see what's happening and then make a theory based off what's happening. So there's a level of assumption there of, we assume men will be in here somewhere and we'll find a way to make it kind of work. But that unfortunately seems to have led to, you know, our assessment tools that we use for eating disorders aren't as accurate for men. Men are more likely to kind of not fit into the eating disorder criteria that we set. And then, you know, even this research that we've done that's mostly focused on men, like muscle dysmorphia, the quality of that research has been really poor. And that's not me just saying it personally, like there's reviews of the kind of quality of the literature and it is really poor. And even the, you know, the research that does involve men with eating disorders, it's often not men with eating disorders. It's men who say they've got disordered eating symptoms or you know, mark that they've got disordered eating symptoms on some kind of scale. But actually, even in the systematic review that we published recently, out of the 1,600 men that were part of these several studies, only like 5% of them actually had an eating disorder. And then like 1% of them said they had some kind of disordered eating. So 94% of them don't even have any symptoms related to it. And we're basing it off of them to some degree, which is, amazing.
Wow. So in terms of the research that you've done, have you basically just had to go right back to the start to do more of what I think you called an inductive approach, or have you kind of come in at a different angle on things?
No, so we use this like EBIP term basically to be a bit more inclusive and a bit more accurate, in the sense that that's way bigger of a task than a PhD. Like, I mean, if I went in and just tried to do an inductive theoretical approach to men's experiences, that could maybe be a PhD, but I'd probably not with enough time to test it for it to be robust enough to actually be used. So rather than doing that, I instead use this term EBIP to be a bit more accurate and say, you know, the men that my research is speaking about, even in the review where we're talking about other people's research, most of them aren't actually men with eating disorders. They aren't actually men with muscle dysmorphia. They're men who have some symptoms that are like it. And a lot of men seem to have symptoms that don't align with those terms. So we instead just use that broader term to be more accurate with it. But when I do talks and stuff, I often don't talk about this stuff because it gets very in the weeds. And as you could probably tell already. And so I just say EBIP's a word that I use. Don't worry about it. Just trust me. Trust me, there's some stuff behind it. Or I just use the word eating.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Order, because people like know kind of what I'm talking about, even though it's not exactly accurate, but it's good enough for now.
No, but I think it is really interesting. And obviously, it's like opened up the conversation around the fact that so much research has been done on women and therefore may not be applicable to men. So in terms of the project that you've done, what was it that led you to think this is what I want to do and this is important because...
Yeah, so I mean, I've done your podcast a number of times, so you know, people can go back and listen to other episodes where I've spoken a bit more about my own lived experience. But partially, it was that I had my own lived experience, and with kind of disordered eating, body image issues around muscularity, which seems to be more common in men, but definitely isn't exclusive to men. We see it across gender, and increasingly more so in kind of women and also kind of gender nonconforming people, but. When I went to the GP, a classic man story of when having an eating disorder, of, you know, went to a GP, kind of got told, don't worry about it. Then, you know, went to counseling, worked on myself. And it took like several months of counseling to even kind of comprehend the fact that my eating and my exercise might have been the problem. And even then, I didn't really kind of connect the dots of eating disorder, because at least my counselor didn't say anything about it. And it took me finding the work of people like Scott Griffiths and Stuart Murray and Jason Nagata and these researchers who looked at muscularity-oriented disordered eating, which is really new. Like, it's only like very, very recent where this kind of research has come out. Like, muscle dysmorphia was like in the early 90s, but MODE's more like kind of 2000s, 2010s, that kind of area, that I even recognized that this was a thing. So we're really far behind. And then I used to work for a place that I won't say, because they previously told me to be kind of, they didn't have a go at me, but when I worked there, they said, don't mention that I worked there for different reasons. But I worked for a place where we reviewed eating disorder services. And when doing those reviews, I would often go there with kind of the lens of men's stuff, and just felt it a lot of the services just felt very feminine. Lots of the images, lots of the information. And, you know, I even had conversations with one person who obviously didn't know my interests, but told me about some kind of loophole that they exploited so they didn't have to include men in their service. Just this general vibe of, I don't think most people are like that, but this one person said that and it stuck with me. I guess that kind of alluded to me that a lot of the messaging you hear about men's mental health in general, and I think in the eating disorder world to some degree as well, is very much like, oh, isn't it a shame that men don't feel comfortable enough to come to us because of masculinity and because men don't want to talk about their feelings? And I was like, oh, maybe there's also, like, you know, some other stuff there. Maybe we could be doing some things as researchers, as clinicians, as services. And that's kind of, yeah, what sparked me to want to do this PhD.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, firstly, I can't imagine if someone's come to review my eating disorder service, then share with them that you have a loophole. It feels like a weird thing to say. But equally, I mean, we've had so many conversations whilst you've been doing your PhD and the things that you've said about the fact of a lot of the material. It's always stuck with me what you said about a lot of the material almost othering men. So like having listed on somebody's website all the different types of eating disorders and then having a male eating disorder section, which, you know, obviously eating disorders may present differently in women and in men, but to have a specific section for it, I don't think a man could have anorexia, a woman could have muscle dysmorphia, like they don't kind of discriminate. So to have it in that separate section always felt very odd.
Yeah, and like you say, it's literally othering them. It's because it's not like the other section is like, oh, this is the woman's and, you know, other genders section and this is the man's one. It's, here's some information, also men are over here. Like, it almost implies that the rest of the website or the rest of the whatever isn't for men. And yeah, for men who, you know, we see in all this research, always feel like they don't belong, they feel like it's a quote-unquote woman's illness, to then literally put them in another section is confirming that potentially. Real issue.
And I mean, I feel really bad asking you over the past 4 years, what have you found out? So that's like, can you summarize that in half an hour? But did you confirm your suspicions with the studies that you've done, or did you find out other things?
Yeah, so I can't summarize everything we found, but I can summarize the important bits from each of the studies we did that led through the kind of narrative. So yeah, so the first study we did, as I mentioned, was this review paper, which is published, so people can go read it, that was looking at the barriers and facilitators to men's help seeking for EBIP, and so for that wider term. And one of the key things we found, as we spoke about, was one of the big barriers that came up was the idea of unwelcoming healthcare. And this was kind of the combination of men and staff who work in services saying, yeah, there's, you know, the system is out to get men and there's like stigma in place within the staff, but also within the actual system itself was the kind of term they often used. And this is stopping men. And also this discussion around resources and around information about how men say that it feels like it confirms the idea that it's not for them and that it's a woman's thing and that it's this kind of thing. But when we kind of looked through the papers, or despite this coming up quite consistently, it was one of the more common themes. We didn't see really any researchers kind of going any further. They would often be like, they would present the results and there'd be this repeated mention of the service being an issue, but then a lot of the discussion would still just talk about masculinity and about men not wanting to seek help. And there's some researchers who talk about this in men's mental health research kind of wider, about the idea of, they call it like a monolithic view of men, of, you know, it's kind of it's almost like a stereotype or like an assumption of just going, oh, it's because men don't want to talk about their mental health. And maybe that, you know, and that is certainly true to some degree, you know, I'm not negating that, but we have to look wider than that. You know, just because that is the case doesn't mean then there isn't other things. So from that, that's kind of when we made the big decision to really hone in on systems and services, because that kind of confirmed the suspicion, and because no one had looked any further. So the next study we did was the one where I talk about this othering that you mentioned before, which was a content analysis, which is basically what I did was I collected 4 sets of documents from, I think it was 16 eating disorder services and 3 charities, like EBIP charities. And we collected outreach resources, so like public-facing information, web pages, specifically the home web page, the web page that lists like symptoms that the service cares for, and anything that's specifically tailored towards men. We also looked at policy, so it was specifically the inclusion-exclusion criteria, so what is it you have to fit to get in and, to not get in. And then finally, like patient handbooks or just information that you get if you get access to the care. And we were looking at it through this kind of like gendered, what's actually in it for first off. So I'm kind of using the NICE guidelines to kind of give us a kind of a code book of what we should be looking for, and finding that. So the various symptoms that were listed, the types of treatment, etc. I mean, then looking at it through this kind of gendered lens of like the images being used, the kind of information that's there. And kind of what we found was that the kind of outer documents, so the public facing information, the outreach resources and the web pages, they seem to be where we found the kind of most risk, or the most like risk of contributing to these negative experiences, negative perceptions from men. Whereas the inner facing information, so the policy was almost fine. If anything, we found that it was more exclusionary of people with kind of like female assigned at birth people, purely because they are, some places exclude you if you're pregnant. So if anything, it excludes kind of the other way to what we were thinking. Although, just to be clear as well, our research, we very much we're talking about men as a gender of like, so we were including kind of trans men, cis men, and looking at it from that kind of lens rather than it being kind of like, yeah, assigned at birth. And then the inpatient handbooks, the information when you get in, images were a bit of an issue, but the information seemed okay. Again, from what we were saying, that it aligned with the guidance that there is regarding how to explain therapy and treatment to men according to like general mental health studies. So it seemed fine. But the outer facing information, the majority of the imagery was very like feminine facing. So me and one of my supervisors, Una Foy, basically coded the images based off our interpretation of the image, whether it we felt it was feminine, felt it was masculine or neutral, and then also looked at the what was it within the images. So if there's a picture of a person, were they like feminine facing, masculine facing, etc., and counted all them up. And basically what we found, it was very boring, but we got there in the end.
Do you and Una agree? Or was it different because
that's why we did that. So that's why we did it. So my supervisors, I've got three of them. Two of them are also men, and then Una's a woman. So I specifically picked Una because we thought, because we've been socialized differently, there would be like slightly different interpretation, just to try and be have a bit more balance there. And we agreed almost on everything. There was maybe like, because it, honestly, a lot of it was, obviously, everyone has different interpretation, but it felt very obvious. Like when it was feminine, it was like excruciatingly feminine. When it was masculine, it was excruciatingly masculine, and vice versa. There was the occasional one that was difficult or like up to grabs. But if we didn't agree, we then took it to my other two supervisors and then had a conversation and then came to an agreement. And we were really kind of robust with it. And I really want, especially with the images, I wanted to make sure there was a lot of those steps in place, because it's so subjective and interpretive. I really wanted to make sure there's a lot of steps of like kind of, yeah, really making sure that it's as accurate as we could be. But yeah, so overall, we found that the images were often feminine leaning, and the information, although often kind of mixed, there were no real examples of like leaning towards masculine symptoms. So like with the outreach resources, there wasn't a single one that spoke about muscularity or muscle dysmorphia or anything like that, which again isn't exclusively gendered, but is often more common in men. And yeah, there was nothing in the outreach resources about male sex hormone like deficiencies or issues regarding to eating disorders, but there's a lot about issues with menstrual cycle. In fact, that was the most common physical symptom we found across the outer facing information. So we kind of came to the conclusion that the risk seems to be housed in this like outer facing public information, almost the way that the way I often talk about it is like the way we market it. So it's all that information that's being shown to people of like, come to our service, or this is what we do as a service. That all feels very feminine and kind of aligns with what the men were saying in our systematic review about it feeling like it confirms that it is feminine, it's not for them. So then from that, because the policy seemed fine, but also from that systematic review that we did before, that there was also the talk about how staff also had this stigma. Staff were also had like lack of knowledge, and a paper I published with Una and Professor Heike Bartel at Nottingham Uni. We published a paper called "It's a Touchy Subject," which is about we basically spoke to people who work in various kind of health settings about men's eating disorders, and they often described it as a touchy subject where no one kind of knows what they're doing, but they all just kind of do their best. So we wanted to ask staff, and we basically, to speed through it, we basically asked them, we gave them vignettes, little case studies. So they were given two. One of them was either a story of a man with thinness orientated concerns, so spoke about the fact that they wanted to get really thin, wanted to lose weight, and then a man with muscularity oriented concerns, so spoke about how they wanted to get really muscular, wanted to get a six pack, big arms. And we specified that both of them were at a quote unquote normal BMI, in case there was some kind of subjectivity there, people thinking that the person with the thin oriented one must have been at low BMI and then assuming that they're more ill or something like that. But like kept them very much the same in behaviors, et cetera, just that difference in what they wanted. And then they were also given a vignette, and that was exactly the same, that described a like bulimia-like symptoms. And the only difference with that was it was the same name. But the only difference was one used he, him pronouns and one used she, her pronouns to see if there's any difference in gender. Basically, what we found was, and we asked them questions about their knowledge and about like bias towards these two characters, and then compared them between the kind of different people who did the survey. We didn't get enough people filling out the survey really to be able to show too much significance. But what we did find was we found no significant differences between muscularity and thinness. So we didn't necessarily see any kind of bias issues or anything with knowledge. Whereas with the gendered one, we did see some difference. So staff said that they felt that men were less likely to seek help without being prompted, which made sense. So the he, him character. Staff also said, which was interesting, that if given the best possible treatment, they reported that the he, him character would get less positive outcomes. So despite having the best possible treatment, they thought the he, him character would get less positive outcomes, which says to me that they kind of know or assume that the treatment isn't as good for men. But actually, when we do research, actually treatment seems to be as good for men as it is for women, but there's something there going on. But the thing we did find that was kind of interesting was we also asked them about the resources they have and how accessible they think they are and how good quality they think they are for this person. And they, on the thin versus muscular and the he, him, staff didn't report any difference in quality, any significant difference in quality or availability.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Despite us finding that when we did our content analysis and men saying that that's the case in the systematic review we did. So that was interesting purely just because it suggests that staff aren't aware of it necessarily, or they just don't say it when asked in a survey for some reason. But there's something interesting there. And also I will say just briefly, because I think the numbers suggest something differently. But as I said, we asked some knowledge-based questions, and one of the knowledge-based questions was for them to kind of say what they thought was the best fit for this person in regards to diagnosis. So what would you diagnose this person with? When we did, and we didn't find any statistical significance between how accurate people were with the different ones, but the numbers are, I think, show something. So with the thinness and the muscularity characters. So the thinness character was basically atypical anorexia, was what you define it as according to the diagnostic. And the muscle one was muscle dysmorphia. 43% of the clinicians accurately diagnosed atypical anorexia, which isn't great, but it's kind of aligning with what some of the other research that done similar things shows. So that's like kind of the standard. And you know, you got to cut the clinicians some slack because it is just one case study, and you know, there's also other factors. We tried to make it as obvious as possible because we basically followed the diagnostic criteria. And then the muscle dysmorphia one, so 43% for atypical anorexia, muscle dysmorphia was 21%. So a big drop, which was interesting. But the one where I think the kicker for me that I think is interesting, which again wasn't statistically significant, but I think it was just because we didn't have enough people. I think if we had a few more people, it would have been, but I can't necessarily say that, was the he, him and she, her one, the gendered ones. So I'll just say again, this was exactly the same, like word for word, exactly the same. One of them said he, one of them said she. I can't remember what the name was we gave, but I think we used like a gender, like kind of neutral name. So like Charlie or something to imply that it could be anyone. So word for word, exactly the same. When it had she, her pronouns, they were 45% of the time accurate. When it had he, him pronouns, they were only 22% accurate. So almost half as accurate, purely. The only thing that changed was that we use he, him pronouns.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
I have wanted to ask you this question so many times when you've explained this to me, and every single time I forget it. So I'm so happy to get this question now. Those two people that are being explained, are they both being explained to the same clinician, or is it different clinicians answering the he one and a different clinician answering the she one?
It's different clinicians. They were randomly assigned. There is certainly a chance that, because it's a between participants rather than within participants.
Yeah.
But that is a common kind of like limitation of research. A lot of people do it that way. There is certainly that chance that we just got all the, not actually, I'm not going to say what I was going to say. We just got all the people who weren't quite as good on one. But because it was randomly assigned, though,
yes,
like the odds of that being the case is,
And I think because it is, you know, if it was a smaller discrepancy, then I think I'd be like, well, I think it matters less. But actually, you know, as you said, like it's randomly allocated and it is literally double the percentage, which I think is so interesting. The fact that it's literally exactly the same information, but there must be something, as you say, about gender playing a role. With regards to the first one that you said about muscle dysmorphia and atypical anorexia, am I correct in thinking muscle dysmorphia, is that a diagnosable condition?
Muscle dysmorphia is in the DSM-5. Yeah. But also to say what you, like, I kind of preempting what you were going to say there, I completely agree. I expected that muscle dysmorphia would be less accurate purely because less people know about it. Like a lot of people don't know that it's in the DSM.
Hmm.
The diagnostic criteria, this would be a whole other podcast. The diagnostic criteria, in my personal opinion, isn't excellent. Some people still think it is. There is a systematic review published a few years ago now by Sebastian Sangren out in Norway, where they basically reviewed, I forget what the actual inclusion criteria was, but basically they reviewed, I think it was 33 papers that had people in them that they claimed had muscle dysmorphia. And these were all papers since the diagnostic criteria had been put in place. Guess what percentage of the papers used the muscle dysmorphia criteria as in the DSM? So guess how many of the researchers used the DSM criteria because they agreed that it was accurate?
I mean, from the way that you're talking, none.
Yeah, 0%. So at that point in that review, every researcher who decided to research muscle dysmorphia decided not to use the muscle dysmorphia criteria. Obviously there could be other reasons, but I, from conversations I have with researchers, I think often it's like, well, they aren't accurate. And yeah, there are studies of come out since then as well where they get people who are like confirmed to have muscle dysmorphia and then ask them questions, and oftentimes they describe symptoms that aren't technically in muscle dysmorphia, which is a whole other kettle of fish. But anyway, so yeah, I agree. I think that the muscle dysmorphia thing sounds more normal, and that's why I said I think the kicker here is that gender difference, because it is the exact same person. And then the final study is this one that I've been speaking about recently, and you were there the other day. So we found from this research, system issues seem to be a problem, like the unwelcoming healthcare, as men call it, or as we called it in that paper. The content analysis suggested it's the public-facing information that seems to be the problem. And when we asked staff, we didn't really find anything necessarily a problem, at least statistically anyway. But we did find that staff don't necessarily seem to think that the resources are an issue, despite men thinking it and us thinking it when we looked at it. So we decided to do a final study where we worked with men co-designing some guidance for services and charities of how to make inclusive materials, inclusive public-facing materials for men. And we really tried to make it that it not only is it kind of instructive of how to design something from scratch, but also tried to make it as informative enough to be reflective. So for those staff members who don't think their resources are a problem or could be an issue, you can kind of have this guidance document, have your resource and go, okay, does it do this? Does it do that? And yeah, hopefully that's useful in that sense to kind of help give some reflection. We can maybe talk a bit more about that.
I mean, I think that the fact, because I mean, this is one thing I wanted to say before about the clinicians maybe getting the incorrect diagnoses or, you know, there being gender biases and things like that. I do, and maybe I am being too nice here, I don't know, but I do often like to approach these kind of things with, and I don't, and this is not what I'm saying that you're saying, that, you know, clinicians unfortunately are so stretched and the training that they receive is so minimal. Without sounding horrible, I often speak to people that work in these services. I'm like, how do you not understand this? Like, I don't, I mean, obviously I speak about eating disorders all the time. I have my own lived experience, but I don't work in the services. I've not had training, but I feel like there's so many kind of misconceptions and stigmas and things like that that are very common amongst clinicians, which is why I think what you've done is so fantastic. Because as you said, rather than kind of saying to people, you're completely wrong and your service is, you know, it's not approachable and not accessible for men, you're doing a shit job, you've actually made something that they can use. They can look at their current materials and cross-reference, which is so much more collaborative rather than just saying you're shit.
Yeah. And yeah, and like, I'm really glad you did say it, because yeah, I don't want to come across that I'm saying that the way that the services are set up and the way that the resources are made aren't fantastic, but I'm not saying that the people who made them are like a problem. I think that they're doing the best they can. Like I said, our entire like theoretical understanding of these things is based on women. They're getting almost entirely women patients into their service, so they're speaking to women, they're often like collaborating with their patients on like how to design these things and stuff, so of course this is going to happen. Like I completely understand it, and they don't, like, before this co-design study and this guidance that we've put out there, as far as I'm aware anyway, there was no guidance on what to do if your like patient was a man or if you wanted to make something that was more inclusive to men. So like, you know, yeah, I completely understand it. And yeah, I'm doing this to try and help with that, rather than be like, you guys are all crap, because I don't think that. Like you say, I speak to people and a lot of times they're incredibly knowledgeable, but they can't know everything. And, you know, it's not just knowing the research. It's also they've got to know, you know, all the pathways and how they've got to do all the policies and all the, you know, protocols. And they've got to have all that memorized, and as well as all this kind of stuff that about where they should change and how they should change. So, like, yeah, it's difficult to kind of keep all that in your head to begin with, never mind actually actioning it and doing something about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think it's always just a really important thing to say, because, you know, sometimes it may come across when people come on the podcast and we talk about maybe their experience or, you know, research and stuff that we're bashing clinicians, but absolutely the fullest respect. You know, everyone's doing the best with what they can. Working together to make it better is all we can do. I suppose with that in mind, again, not to ask you to consolidate your work into 30 seconds, but if clinicians, I guess, are listening, or maybe you want to explain what kind of the different conversations that you had with the men about the resources that are available, what did you find out?
Yeah, so I won't go into the full details of the study just for time's sake, but we really focused on making this research as grounded in like men's experiences as possible, even from the questions we asked men were informed by a survey where we asked just anyone who identifies as a man and is over 18 to give their thoughts about how we could get men to think about this. Because and part of the thought process with that was by like asking men, even if they don't have experience or acknowledged experiences, a lot of men who experience these conditions don't think they have them. And we wanted to try and get to the, like, you know, so a bunch of men who don't think they have issues, what do you think if you did have these issues, hypothetically, what would you do? Or how could we reach you? And so we really grounded it in those kind of experiences. And we spoke to these 6 lived experience partners who we got in the end, who kind of opted in to take part in this co-design process. And we had conversations with them. 3 of them chose to do one-to-one interviews with me, and then 3 of them chose to do a focus group with me and one of my co-facilitators, who was James Downs, who's been on the pod recently, actually, I saw.
2 weeks ago.
yeah. James is fantastic. And we spoke to these men, and we came up with these themes, and there was 5 kind of overarching themes that are then put into the guidance in various different ways, not quite as like matter of fact as what I'm saying here, because I tried to make them a bit more accessible. Because part of this co-design as well was I also worked with clinicians from NHS and private services and people from charities, the First Steps ED, as well as academics. The feedback from them was, how do I make this so you'll actually use it? Rather than me just making something and being like, oh, you should do this, and finger wagging, like, what? Like, how do I make this in a way that you guys will actually want to do it? And that was really helpful. But anyway, yeah, I spoke to these men. And the 5 themes are, so the first one is this idea of designing accessible resources that navigate men's readiness. And this concept of readiness is kind of a term, I don't think I'm like coining it, but like we're using it to kind of smush together these conversations of like mental health literacy and eating disorder literacy. So actually, like, how much do you know about it? How can you, are you able to recognize the symptoms? And also the kind of stigma and barriers towards help seeking, and how far along the chain are men towards actually wanting to seek help. And the kind of examples that I often give when I talk about this are, we spoke a lot about the bodybuilding community when we did these conversations. And, you know, if you have, you know, Andy, who is a bodybuilder, fits all the criteria for muscle dysmorphia or for bulimia or whatever, but he just thinks it's part of his bodybuilding journey. He knows it negatively affects his life, but he hasn't quite put the pieces together, because he thinks that going to the gym is helping him, because he does feel better when he does it, but then also like it's having all these negative impacts on his relationships and these kind of things. And, you know, that it would benefit from accessing care, but has no idea about it, versus Charlie, who like has self-diagnosed himself with binge eating disorder, is aware of his local service, but is too scared to seek help. Those two men need very like vastly different information, vastly different formats of information. You know, the bodybuilding guy needs something that's going to pop up to him. So he might need social media, might need podcasts. Whereas the Charlie, who knows he's got a thing, he needs a web page. He needs a leaflet from that service that is going to invite him in and tell him what to do and how to do it. And it was all about that kind of, and there's some, we're writing the paper up at the moment. And there are also some tips like in the actual guidance document, but talking about like how to kind of action that. The second theme was the idea of authentic voices. And this was very much centered around the idea of creating these resources about conversations between men. So having men speak to each other and then building a resource based off of that, and how that kind of leads to authenticity and that kind of thing. Next is this idea of self-realization, which was basically the idea of trying not to label men's behaviors and experiences in your resources. Because men said that can feel, the men that are lived experience partners said that can feel quite alienating and even aggressive, one of the men said, rather than saying, if you do A, B, and C, you've probably got an eating disorder, you need to come to us. Instead, say, this man, Tony, he did A, B, and C, and then he came to us, and now he's doing DEF. And, you know, isn't that amazing? And then I can go, I do what Tony does. I can self-realize, I can go, oh shit, I do what Tony does, and that does also negatively affect me. Maybe I should go and seek help too. So encouraging that self-realization, as well as just using prompts as well. So like questions and like getting people to think for themselves. Theme 4 was around purpose and progress. So really pushing this idea of not just saying it's okay not to be okay, that messaging of men said it feels quite passive, instead kind of giving a purpose and progress to that. So it is okay not to be okay, but also if you come to us, we can do X, Y, and Z, and we can help you. And so adding that to it as well. And also this idea of working around masculinity and around how, like, a lot of men's idea of masculinity is very progress driven, very purpose driven of I'm going to do this, I'm going to get this. A lot of self-development stuff there, and trying to frame help seeking, frame this care as a way of an alternative form of masculinity in various ways. One example can be like framing help seeking as a form of self-improvement. So, you know, rather than saying if you're broken and we can come fix you, instead come to us and you'll get to learn about how your brain works, and you'll get to be able to recognize patterns and make educated decisions about like the things that are going on, the emotions you're feeling. And then the final one was this a concept of images, and basically talking about how they can be both helpful and harmful, and it's difficult to kind of think about it. And the interesting thing with this, in a nutshell, was that the men spoke about how if we think about like hypermuscularity bodies in the eating disorder world, it's basically a no-go. You never show kind of extreme pictures of people's bodies or bodies at all, but the men spoke about how you know, hypermuscular bodies are unlike hyperthin bodies, which is kind of where the rule is built around, in that they're still seen societally as healthy and often praised to be healthy. But actually using those images, men are already going to be seeing them. But if we use them and then add nuanced messaging about them, saying about the issues that can come from them, what can happen, you can actually, rather than actually kind of pushing that narrative and perpetuating it, instead you can add some nuance to it and actually help kind of intervene, especially for those men who are like bodybuilders and stuff, who are already looking at those images all the time. You can actually get in there and make a difference.
I have so many questions, but I feel like there's a common theme, so I'm gonna try and tie them together. So I guess in respect to what you were saying about, like, there's one person who's self-diagnosed eating disorder, there's one person that's bodybuilder, and the self-diagnosed person will need very different content to the other person. So my first point was, like, initially, like, getting that information across to them, like, where are you recommending that information is put? So, for example, the person that doesn't know necessarily they've got an eating disorder but are engaging in those disordered behaviours, you mentioned social media and podcasts, but are there, like, specific places or, like, specific ways that people can target them? You know, I'm thinking, like, the classic thing is using algorithms and stuff, or would that be completely unethical? But then I guess the point that's tied into that, and I think you kind of touched on it when you were talking as well, is like, particularly when you think about like hypermasculinity and the kind of people that are at the gym, you know, muscle dysmorphia, very disordered behaviours, but see it as positive. There's so much content out there, particularly on social media, that is like, pain is weakness, leaving the body. You've just got to keep pushing. Like that, you know, any weakness that you have, like just keep showing up, just keep going to the gym, just keep eating the chicken, just keep grinding down your protein. Like that's what you need to do in order to be successful. I totally am with you. And I think that the movement into showing those images of people that, you know, are considered hypermasculine, actually they're potentially struggling with their mental health, what have you, definitely the direction to go in. But I'm just like thinking, in reality, are the people that are so deeply entrenched into that even gonna have their ears up to listen to somebody potentially saying to them? Because I know people that are like that, and I'm goddamn sure if I don't even think that I would broach the subject with them, because you'd just be shut out. But I guess what I'm just trying to say is, like, are we going to be able to access those people, or like, have you thought about those cases? Because I think theoretically it all sounds fantastic, but I'm just thinking, in reality, are they even going to be up for listening?
Yeah, so I just noted down the points as you were going. So going back to your original one about kind of getting the information across to people and like ways to do that. We talk about in the guidance and also in the paper, one of the things that the men also spoke. So one of them is that, you know, the idea of kind of, I think using algorithms is fine. You know, you're using it for a positive cause. I maybe have to think a bit more like kind of philosophically to really get into the ethics of that. But I think that's fine. But there's another aspect of, you know, for people, for services and charities, working with local groups or initiatives where men are already involved. So, you know, like men are maybe more likely to get involved with like a men's talking group, or more likely to get involved with like a charity like Mind, or like a bit more kind of generic mental health charity. But the specificity of eating disorders might still be a barrier to them. So working with companies like that, groups like that can be a really good way of men already feeling comfortable in a space to talk. And this also goes to, there's lots of research about like kind of barbershops and football and football groups and that kind of thing. Spaces where men already feel safe, so to speak, and comfortable in order to speak. And then kind of bringing in an extra bit of conversation about this stuff can be a really great way to do that as well. So yeah, there's kind of various things with that. And then in regards to the, like, I guess the extreme masculine fitness kind of overlap, there's something I've thought about a lot. And there's, I think, I don't know if I've spoken about it with you before, but there's kind of a term that I use, that I used to use, I've actually kind of stopped using it to some degree, but just for the sake of this, I'll refer to it as the masculine fitness intersect, which was basically this idea that, and it's something I've been writing about for a bit, the value system from bits of research anyway, of traditional masculinity and of the fitness community and like fitness social space, fitness culture, as people always say, almost perfectly overlap. That, you know, this idea of pushing through pain, this idea of dedication, this idea of taking up space, being big and strong, like and what we often see when people who have issues around muscularity, to be specifically, one of the most common correlators with that, in fact the most common correlator with drive for muscle, is masculine discrepancy. So the idea that you're not masculine enough. Some of the research that one of my supervisors, Dr. Christian Edwards, has done has found that a lot of men who have very high drive for muscle, often their life story kind of goes around this concept of being taught when they were younger that they're not masculine enough and then taking on muscle building as a way to prove they are. So there are these men who are like their identity is completely tied to it. Part of the answer to that question is kind of what you alluded to, and is kind of the case for, I think, most forms of eating disorder, body image, etc., is if someone's that tied to it, there isn't a way to stop them. But that's the case for, you know, you could say that for every like illness to some degree. You know, if someone doesn't want it, then it's really hard to get them to do it. But I don't, and I'm not that you're saying this, but I don't think that means we shouldn't try. You know, I was that person, and what we see, and it took me becoming suicidal to actually be able to like realize I should seek help. And unfortunately, the only facilitators we found to men's help seeking in my systematic review were either their loved ones get involved, often in quite like problematic ways from what we found. And so like maybe not problematic because I understand they're in a stressful situation, but like forcing them to go or giving them an ultimatum, which can be stressful, obviously, or something significant, like a significant critical life event happens, aka they're hospitalized, or like they have a major relationship breakdown that sparks them to feel like they have to seek help. And I think the reality is that most men like me have to get to the point where they are like going to die or everything is falling apart for them to consider seeking help. Currently, like, it's not quite as black and white as this, but currently a lot of the responses are men just need to like sort out masculinity and start talking about their feelings more, which is great and is true, and we do need to, but also we need to do something as services and as, you know, as people. And I think stuff like this guidance document, the things that can be created from this are a good step towards that. And it won't work for everyone, but some people will learn new information and start to question it. Very recently, I saw a video with Hathor Bjornsson, the Mountain from Game of Thrones, talking with Dr. Mike Israetel, and they were training together. During that, Thor says that he thinks he had body dysmorphia a few years ago, and he was struggling with the way he looked. And he said, "Oh, I was X weight, I was competing in as World's Strongest Man, and I looked in my mirror and I always just thought I was too small." So like these conversations are already happening. So I think there, you know, there's potential for this to break through more so than we maybe think.
No, I completely agree. And my response was going to be exactly the same in terms of what you said, in that it may not be that right now every single man in the world recognizes that there's a problem potentially with their relationship with food and exercise and their body, or feels comfortable in talking about it. But if you don't open up these conversations, and if you don't have services in place for when they do come forward, if they do want to, like, I think that the best thing we can do is prepare, and as you said, open up these conversations. And I think that, you know, particularly celebrities, they have such a big role to play in you know, the opening up of these conversations. And I think from, you know, using it as an example, like we've seen it very much with neurodivergence. Like a few years ago, I think that a lot of people were, you know, maybe not wanting to share that they were neurodivergent. And then more and more celebrities that have spoken about it have almost normalized the conversation about it. It means that other people have then been able to share as well. And I think that we genuinely will see that trend with men coming forward and speaking about their lived experience. And, you know, I think, you know, not every single person has an eating disorder or disordered eating, but I think most people can relate to the fact that some days they've felt a bit off in their body or what have you. And I imagine, you know, that's going to be the same with men, that some people will have, you know, a diagnosable muscle dysmorphia. Some people will be able to relate to the fact that they don't really like their body sometimes. And the more that we're having those conversations, obviously I don't want people to be struggling. It'd be a beautiful world if nobody had those issues. But I think it's fantastic that you're doing the work that you're doing and understanding more about how men see themselves and their way that they access services and things like that, so that services can improve the support that they have for when men are ready.
Yeah, I completely agree. And the one thing I'll add at the end is, because I think it's really important for these conversations, and I know you agree with this too, as much as we've been talking about men here, and like with the muscularity thing, there is no like men, there is no like monolithic idea of men think this way and want this way and that kind of thing. And to, you know, to add to all of this, the general caveat is, you know, this has to be inclusive and has to be a growing kind of constant pursuit of trying to reach men and whatever that is. And we need like multiple things that are reaching out to different groups and different men. And I think that's the way forward.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think getting across that idea that, you know, there's no one way that an eating disorder or disordered eating or what have you would look in a man, just as the same that we're trying to break through that in women. And I know we have had so many conversations about me rambling on about how, you know, originally everyone thought that anorexia was the only eating disorder, or it was the female eating disorder. Let's not do the same now that we're doing that breakthrough with men and muscle dysmorphia. So, yeah, I think it's so important, as you said, to really get across that there's no one way that it shows up for anybody. I don't know where that hour has just gone. That's the reason we're such good friends, isn't it? Because we can just talk forever. I'm going to ask you to share all the links of the papers and stuff that you've mentioned so I can put them in the show notes. But where can people go to find out more about you?
Just Google MyoMinds, or yeah, go to myominds.co.uk. You can see a bunch of stuff there.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. It has been so nice to chat to you and very much appreciate your time.
Thanks, Anne.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode on the Full of Beans podcast. I really hope you did enjoy it. As a little reminder, this is not a replacement for therapeutic advice, so please do seek support if you are struggling and know that there will always be somebody there to listen. Many thanks once again to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital. Have a lovely week, and I will see you next week for another episode of the Full of Beans podcast.